Assalamu alaikum students. On behalf of the Virtual University of Pakistan, Ministry of Science and Technology and Mubashir Humayun, I welcome you to another lecture in financial management. In the last lecture, we introduced the area of working capital management or current asset management. And in this lecture, we will continue that discussion and we will move on to the area of working capital financing. At the close of the previous lecture, we spoke about cash management policies. And we mentioned that financial managers use various general policies in order to manage the cash. One of these policies is called the synchronization policy. And this is based on billing cycles. And the objective of this policy is to try to match the incoming cash flows with the outgoing cash flows. So ideally speaking, the firm should receive incoming cash flows at a certain date in the month, and the cash outflows should be on a date shortly after that. They should not take place before the cash inflows, otherwise there will be a temporary cash flow problem. Another policy that is pursued is speedy collection of cash, quick collection of cash, and firms use collection teams within the company as well as collection agencies in order to recover their money from the market. And this problem of course arises because competition forces companies to extend credit to the customer. In other words, for example, in the case of the fabrics market in Pakistan, there are so many fabric manufacturers and wholesalers that they have to offer a good deal to the customer. And most of them offer to you that you can buy the fabric without paying cash and that you can pay the cash 1 month or 2 months later. And that is called selling on credit. And this means that after 1 month or 2 months, they have to get their cash. And this can be a difficult exercise if the buyer does not plan to pay up. Finally, another policy that is used in cash management is known as the float policy. And over here, the objective is to manage the incoming checks that are received in the name of the company and the checks that are issued by the company to others, like suppliers from whom the firm buys raw materials and supplies. And ideally speaking, the firm should try to maximize the speed at which they collect the check, deposit it in the bank, so that it can be credited into their account. And if they're able to do this a lot faster than the people whom they're issuing the checks to, then they will have a net positive float, a net surplus of cash in their bank account. And this will allow them to take care of day-to-day expenses, out-of-pocket expenses, and possibly even emergency expenditures. Now, I should mention over here that what we spoke about in dividend policy is related to cash management because dividends are paid out of cash. And the point to remember over here related to dividend policy is also that it's very important. I mentioned that cash is an idle asset because it does not generate any rate of return for the company. And we can also take a look at the dividend payouts in this respect. How does a company decide whether or not to give dividends and how much dividends to give? Well, one other way of looking at the dividend policy issue is to take a look at the Gordon's formula. You will recall that Gordon's formula for share pricing is as follows. The share price, P naught, is equal to div 1, the forecasted dividend in the next year, divided by R sub E minus G, where RE is the required rate of return on the equity, and G is the growth rate in the dividends. Now, if we change the numerator from div 1 to EPS multiplied by div 1 over EPS, which is the same term if you cancel out the EPSs. And if you divide that by RE minus G, where G is equal to the growth rate, which is equal to the plowback times the ROE, then you have all the variables in this formula that can help you to determine when a company should pay dividend and when it shouldn't. This is one criteria. And the criteria is as follows. In the formula, then, we have that the share price P0 is equal to EPS multiplied by div 1 divided by EPS, all divided by RE minus plowback times ROE. Now, you have the two rate of returns in this formula that can help you decide. One of them is the RE, which is the required rate of return on equity. The other one is the ROE, return on equity, which is a financial accounting ratio. ROE is the return on equity, the net income divided by the common equity value. And the required rate of return on the equity is the same actor that we studied in the risk theory and also in the capital asset pricing model. So we can now come up with a criteria, and that criteria is as follows. Whenever the return on equity, which is the financial accounting ratio for the firm, is less than the required rate of return, RE, then what it means is that the company is not able to generate a sufficient rate of return. In other words, the return on equity is less than the required return on equity. The shareholders and investors require a higher return. The ROE of the company is lower than what the shareholders and investors require. Therefore, in that case, since the company is not able to find projects and investments good enough to generate a higher rate of return, it is better for the firm to give out the cash in the form of dividends. And in this particular case, when the ROE is less than the RE, in other words, when the required rate of return is higher than the return on equity, in this particular case, if the firm decides to give out dividends, it will have a positive impact on the share price. So in this case, where the ROE is less than the RE, in other words, when the return on equity is less than the required return on equity, then it is better for the firm, generally speaking, to give away the spare cash in the form of dividend, because they are unable to use it in a better way that can generate a higher rate of return than the shareholders want. So it's better to give them the cash in the form of dividend. And the opposite is the case in the other situation, where if the return on equity is greater than RE, in that case, the company is able to generate a higher rate of return than what the shareholders require. Therefore, in this particular case, the company might decide to plow back the money to keep retained earnings and to save them for the projects and investments in which they are investing their money and generating a superior rate of return, a rate of return that will lead this company to have an ROE greater than the RE. So in this particular case, where the return on equity is higher than the required rate of return, the company is able to generate a rate of return on its investments and projects which is higher than what the shareholders require. Therefore, in this case, it makes sense for the company to retain the cash and the earnings in the form of retained earnings and to plow them back into the company and into new projects rather than giving them out in the form of cash dividends. Because remember that the cheapest way to finance for a company is to use its own internally generated retained earnings. Now, in this particular case, when the ROE is greater than the required rate of return, if the firm decides to give out cash dividends, then that will have a negative effect on the share price. And finally, if the ROE is equal to the required rate of return, in that case, the dividend payout has no impact on the share price. Now, this was a brief recap of the dividend policy. Let me come back to the material we're talking about right now, which is working capital management. We have already spoken about cash management, and now let's proceed to the next area, which is inventory management. I don't want to spend too much time on this particular area because it's covered in reasonable amount of detail in financial accounting. However, just for review, let me recap some of the important concepts. There are three basic types of inventories. One is the raw material. The second is the work in process. And the third is called finished goods. And they're at various stages of the production process. The finished goods are also the finished products which are finally sold, either on credit or for cash. Now, in the case of inventories, there are various important issues to consider. In financial accounting, you must have spent a considerable amount of time going through various kinds of inventory valuation methods. FIFO, LIFO, average cost, and various other methods are available, which makes the valuation of inventory a subjective and tricky exercise. Therefore, the calculation of the cost of goods sold is also difficult. You can never be sure what the exact cost of the finished goods that you're selling is, because it depends on the age of the goods and their carrying costs and so on. That's one issue. Another issue is, of course, that inventory has to be acquired before the sales. Naturally, you have to buy the raw materials and supplies, and then they are fed into the production process, and that takes a certain number of days or weeks for the product to be manufactured or completed, after which the finished good is ready. So it's only after that that the sales can be made. Inventory has to be bought before the sales. Therefore, you have to estimate what the expected inventory levels will be like based on your sales forecast. And based on historical data for the firm, you can calculate what is known as the economic order quantity, or EOQ. And production management and operations management spends a great deal of time in these type of exercises. But basically, the economic order quantity can be calculated as the optimum order size for each kind of supply that you have in the inventory. Now, this is a critical number to calculate because any shortfall, in other words, if the EOQ that you've estimated turns out to be less than the actual requirement of inventory, then there will be an interruption in the production process. And there will be a loss in the sales. Similarly, if the economic order quantity that has been estimated is too high, then there is dead inventory lying in the godown or in the warehouse, which is being spoiled and it's being wasted and depreciated. And we have to be very mindful of the fact that we do not want to have an excessive amount of inventory in the warehouse, because it is subject to spoilage and wastage and depreciation, and that costs money. Another issue that we have to consider in inventory is the possibility of a peak in the sales. All of a sudden, sometimes a shop owner has to face a sharp rise in the sales. Why? Because maybe it is Eid time, and supposing we're talking about a shoe store, and a lot of ladies and kids come to the store to do their Eid shopping. So in this particular case, shopkeepers in advance plan for Eid, and they decide to maintain excess or extra levels of inventory. Their inventory levels are higher than normal. before each time because they expect a large demand. Now, if they do not have enough money to buy this inventory, and if they cannot buy it on credit, then they might have to rely on short-term borrowing or a short-term loan from the bank to finance the purchase of this inventory. And this can be a very risky thing to do, because if they are unable to sell this extra inventory, then they might have to take a desperate measure like selling the inventory at a discount. Therefore, they will incur a loss. And this loss will appear in the retained earnings, negative retained earnings. So even though there is cash trickling in, this cash is from sales that are being made at a loss. And the retained earnings will drop. And the firm will not have enough cash to repay the loan that they have taken. They might face insolvency that we spoke about, financial distress, and bankruptcy. So inventory management is very, very critical, and it is a fatal mistake to make that financial managers have to make sure that they spend a great deal of time and plan their inventory management. There are very important costs associated with inventory management. Carrying inventory, keeping supplies and raw materials in a warehouse has a cost attached to it. Well, the most obvious cost is that you are keeping goods in a warehouse, and that warehouse might be on rent, so you have to pay a rental. That is part of what we call carrying costs. Carrying costs include the rental that is paid for storage. It can include the cost of capital. Cost of what capital? The capital that is tied up in the inventory. Remember, I mentioned that in working capital, there is actual money that is stuck up in inventory. It's not generating any return. So the cost of capital can be high if the inventory levels are very high. Also, the goods that are kept in warehouse are insured against fire and theft, and insurance protection costs money. That is another carrying cost associated with inventories. And finally, of course, there is wastage, spoilage, and depreciation of supplies and raw materials that are just sitting in the warehouse. That is also part of carrying cost. So carrying cost is one category of costs. Another category of cost is the shipping and handling costs. These are costs that are incurred when you order the supplies and raw materials from a supplier, and he has to send them to you by airmail or by train or by ship or by car or by truck. Transport costs money, and that is part of the shipping and handling costs. And the final category of costs is a very important one, but it is difficult to estimate, and that is the cost of a shortfall in the inventory. The cost of running short. This is the cost that you have to bear if you did not keep enough inventory to adequately meet the supplies. If the inventories were too short, if the inventories were less than the sales, in that case, you face a shortfall and you would lose out on the sales. And there's a cost associated with that. You lose the sales, you lose the customers, and you lose goodwill. Goodwill is the credibility and the bond that a company makes with its buyers, that they will supply on time and that they will have various product qualities available at all times. You break this goodwill. So these are real costs. Generally speaking, the most important of these costs is the carrying cost. And it can be as high as 20 to 30% of the total inventory value. So if you have 1,000 rupees of inventory, you might have as much as 200 to 300 rupees of carrying costs. The shipping and handling costs are generally less than 5% of the inventory value. And the costs associated with the running short of inventory depend from firm to firm and on the value of the inventory. Now let's talk about inventory management policies. and various methods by which managers control inventory. Inventory management has become an incredibly technology-driven procedure and process. Nowadays, you find all kinds of sophisticated computer programs that will help the management to monitor the inventory right from the computer screen. They can be thousands of miles away from the warehouse, and they can monitor their inventories. They might not even have the need for a warehouse, and they might be monitoring the inventories right at the point of supply, at their suppliers. So there is an area that is known as ERP and economic resource planning, also includes inventory management. There are various softwares that have been developed that are dynamic softwares. Dynamic softwares take into account not just the static economic order quantity value that I spoke about earlier, but they take into account a changing aspect in inventory, which is the changes in the usage rate. In other words, these softwares are able to track how the spending pattern of the customer and the buyer is changing with time, and they change the economic order quantity based on the changes in the usage rate, based on the changes in the demand for the finished good. So it is incredibly technology driven. Another kind of state-of-the-art inventory management policy that is used is known as just-in-time management. And just-in-time was kicked off by Toyota of Japan, and their philosophy was to minimize the amount of time that any supply for the car has to spend in inventory. In other words, cars have various supplies such as the bumper and the lights and the plastic molding, the steering wheel, carburetors and so on, and they might be supplied by different suppliers and vendors. Each one of them is a separate company or separate factory located somewhere in Japan. In the case of Toyota, they finally bought their suppliers very close to them. But the objective in JIT, or just-in-time management, is to order the supply just a few hours before it is actually used in making the car. And the beauty of the system is that there are hardly any carrying costs, and there is virtually no need for a warehouse. Of course, the latest hierarchy of this development is what we see in the internet companies, and particularly in the B2B and the B2C type of ventures. In the case of many of these companies, there are no physical warehouses. They source the supplies and even the finished goods from various people around the world, and they supply them to the customer. So they are just the middlemen in the buying and the selling process. Finally then, another aspect of inventory management that is important to understand is known as outsourcing. Outsourcing has become very popular because why should a company manufacture and produce every subcomponent or part of the finished product that they're making? They may not be the best at producing all of the parts of the finished product. For example, if somebody is making a shirt, then the manufacturer of the shirt or the stitching unit may not be the best person to manufacture the buttons of the shirt or the thread that is used for sewing the shirt. So why should he make it? There are others who are better at this, more efficient, less costly. So he decides to outsource or to buy these parts from them at a lower cost. This also avoids the need to employ a very, very large workforce and possible unionism problems. So these are some of the different techniques that are being used in inventory management. And in outsourcing, I should point out that it has become very popular, and it has really helped Pakistan's technology sector because multinational companies, large companies in America, have IT or information technology divisions, but they have decided that it is too expensive for them to use their own computer programmers to write computer software. They might have to pay as much as maybe $100, $150, $200 per hour to their own software programmers who are American citizens. So instead, they decide that it is a lot more cost effective to give the assignment of writing the software code and the program to intelligent and dynamic young computer software engineers and programmers, such as some of you who are watching. And this way they can save money, because when they give the contract to a Pakistani software house, maybe their cost is only something like $20, $30, or $50 per man hour. So outsourcing is also a very important aspect of inventory management. Okay, so we were just talking about just-in-time management and Toyota Motor Company. So let's change gears and move to another area, which is that of accounts receivable management. Account receivables are also part of current assets, and account receivables include the money that you have to collect from various buyers to whom you have extended credit. Now, as I mentioned, credit sales have become a practical necessity because competition in the market has forced companies to sell their goods, their products and services on credit. They will give the good or the product to you today, and they will ask you to pay after 1 month or 2 months. Now, following the sale, they then have to ensure that the money is actually collected. Now, you have to keep in mind that whenever a firm extends credit to a customer by temporarily providing him the product or the service for free, for at least a month, after which they have to pay, then for that period of time, the credit term or the credit duration, the firm has to arrange some sort of financing because they need to buy inventory to make further sales, and they have not received any cash from the sales that they have made. So there is a temporary cash shortfall whenever a company sells on credit. And you have to keep in mind that other than the profit margin part of the sales price, the remaining portion has to be financed in some manner. And it might be financed through short-term loans or borrowings, or by liquidation or sale of an asset, or possibly even by raising external equity or shares issuance. Generally speaking, firms prefer to use short-term borrowing. Now, there are two types of formulas that we use to calculate the account receivables. And going through these formulas will help us to understand how we can control the account receivables to a manageable level. Remember that the financial managers of a firm have to make sure that they limit the amount of credit that they give in the market. Otherwise, they might not be able to recover all of their money. It becomes very risky when companies have large amounts of account receivables. The first formula is that the account receivables is equal to the credit sales per day multiplied by the average number of days of credit that is given. So, for example, if a wholesaler of cotton fabric extends 10,000 rupees of credit to his buyers every day, let's suppose, and then he is extending an average of 30 days of credit. In other words, every day he gives or supplies fabric worth 10,000 rupees to various people in the market, and he asks them to pay him after 1 month or after 30 days. So what is the account receivables then? Well, the accounts receivable at any given time, the average account receivable is simply equal to the credit sales per day multiplied by the average number of days of credit. So that is equal to 10,000 rupees multiplied by 30 days, and that is equal to 300,000 rupees. 3 lakh rupees of this fabric wholesaler's money that is stuck in the market. This money is in rolling. This is what the people in the business community, the term that they use is that the money is stuck up and it's in rolling in the market. So this is a necessary price that businessmen have to pay in order to remain in business. The second formula for accounts receivables is as follows, that the account receivables is equal to the daily total sales multiplied by the ACP. Now here we're talking about total sales and not credit sales. The ACP is simply equal to the average collection period. Now let's do a simple example to explain to you how you calculate the average collection period. If you take a look at the slide, you will see that the ACP or average collection period can be calculated. It is the weighted average of the days of credit, and it can be obtained from the aging schedule that you studied in financial accounting. So for example, if a firm makes 30% of its sales on 30-day credit and 70% of the sales on 60-day credit, then the average collection period or ACP is equal to the weighted average, which is equal to 0.3 times 30 plus 0.7 times 60 days, and that is equal to 51 days. So the ACP for this firm is equal to 51 days. Now, what do these account receivable formulas tell us? They tell us that the firm has to minimize the ACP, the average collection period. And they also tell us that the firm has to minimize the daily credit sales. So there are two aspects of managing account receivables. Reduce the amount of credit that you give every day and reduce the average number of days for which you give the credit. There is a value component to it and a time component to managing account receivables. Now, there is an aspect of financial management that is connected to accounts receivable, and that is credit management. They are linked. Credit and collection and account receivables are all linked. Now, the first aspect of credit policy is to make sure that the firm is giving credit to credit-worthy individuals and buyers. If the firm thinks that it is giving credit to a person or a company that is going to run away, then they should not be giving the credit. And this is a matter of credit quality. Banks have to spend a great deal of time on this credit quality aspect when they're giving loans to various businessmen. They have to make sure that they're credit worthy. And the State Bank of Pakistan also helps them in the CIB report regarding the credit worthiness and the market worthiness of various businesses and businessmen. Of course, we mentioned that the firm should try to minimize the average collection period or ACP. And now it's time to talk about some creative techniques that firms can use in order to reduce their account receivables and to manage their credit. One such technique is to incentivize or give an incentive to buyers who are willing to pay cash immediately. So it is in the interest of the company if a buyer is willing to pay cash right now, because then they would not face a cash flow problem. And they can easily synchronize their cash inflow with their cash outflow. So let's take a look at a simple example of how firms can incentivize their customers by giving them a discount for cash payments. If you take a look at the slide, you will see that this particular firm is making the following offer. They will sell on 5x10 net and 30 basis. Now, what does this coded expression mean? Well, 30 basis means simply that the customer must pay the full cash value within 30 days. And 5x10 net means that the firm is willing to offer a 5% discount on the price to the customer who is willing to pay within 10 days. So the company is rewarding those customers that can pay cash quickly. It is said that certain economic powers these days follow a carrot and stick policy. And that means that when you need to get something done, not only should you offer a reward to somebody, but you should also threaten them with a certain amount of punishment. Well, credit management is the same way. Just as companies can give incentives to customers who pay cash quickly, similarly, they can penalize those customers who pay them late. And this takes the form of late payment charges, which I'm sure all of you have seen in some bill that you've received or another, late payment surcharge, and so on. So let's now take a look at an example of a company and how it uses the late payment penalties. So this is a simple example where the firm is charging a 2% late payment charge if the bill is not paid within 30 days. Now, 2% per month is a very large amount. It means 24% penal interest per year. That's a great way to make money. So, for example, if the customer does not pay 100,000 rupees bill within 1 month, then he will have to pay 2,000 rupees extra for every month that he is late. Well, this is simply amazing, because what this tells us is that you can not only use credit policy for saving money, but you can also actually make money and a good rate of return from credit policy, intelligent credit policy. How's that? Well, if you are charging 2% per month interest in the form of penalty for late payment, then your rate of return on the penalty is 24% per year, and that is an excellent rate of return. So some companies are actually making money from these penalties. And I dread to mention that the credit card companies and some other companies are first in line. Now, let's change gears again and move to a very, very important area that is connected to working capital management, and that is working capital financing. This is the other side of the coin. Now that we have discussed how firms set the best value for their current assets, let's find out how firms decide how they should finance the purchase of these current assets. How does a firm decide whether they should use a short-term loan or a long-term loan in order to buy the inventory? Now, before we move into that, we should realize that the sales fluctuate with time and with the season. There are various industries like sugar, for example, sugar mills, and various other fruit manufacturing businesses and so on that are very seasonal. So there are a lot of businesses that have seasonal sales fluctuations, and therefore their inventories also fluctuate a lot, and we need to decide what the best way for these firms is to source the financing to buy the inventory and the raw materials. For example, is it best for a sugar mill to buy the sugar cane from short-term loans or from long-term loans? Now, another thing that we should realize is that the inventory levels not only fluctuate depending on the nature of the business. For example, the fluctuations in the inventory will be different for a sugar mill compared to the shopkeeper of shoes, because the nature of the business is different. They will also fluctuate depending on the macroeconomic picture. For example, if a country is undergoing an economic boom or prosperity, then generally companies will keep high inventories. And similarly, if a country is going through an economic depression or recession, then you will find that the general level of inventories is low, because businesses are trying to minimize the cash which is stuck up in inventories and minimize their cost of capital. Now, even though firms are trying to minimize the unnecessary and excessive inventory, they can never reduce the inventory levels to zero. There is always a minimum permanent current inventory that they have to maintain. And if we generalize this concept, we can say that even within current assets, there is a small but limited permanent portion of the current assets. Now, this is different. I'm not talking about the fixed assets. That's different. That is movable and immovable properties, such as cars and property, land and building. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that within current assets, there is a minimum amount that the company has to maintain at all times for business operations. And we can call that the permanent portion of the current assets. So then we can define the total assets of a company. The total assets is equal to the fixed assets plus the permanent portion of the current assets plus the temporary or spontaneous portion of the current assets. And by categorizing the total assets in this manner, we can then look into a few different types of working capital financing policies and understand how companies decide how much and where they should use the short-term loans and the long-term loans in order to buy inventory. So firstly, let me recap quickly some of the advantages of short-term financing and short-term loans over long-term loans. Short-term loans are of a short duration. They are more flexible. You can enter, go into, and come out of this agreement quickly. They are flexible and they are more easy to obtain than long-term financing that requires the firm to submit a lot of financial statements to the bank. Not only this, but generally speaking, since we studied bond yields and bond pricing earlier, we are familiar with the yield curve. And you will recall that I mentioned that normally the yield curve is upward sloping. And that means that short-term loans are generally cheaper and less costly than long-term loans. So these are some of the advantages of short-term borrowing. Of course, the disadvantage of short-term borrowing is that the overall long-term cost for your debt will be uncertain because you have locked in a rate of return or an interest rate for a short period of time, maybe a few months or a year at most. That's what short-term means over here. So there is no guarantee that you'll be able to get as good or as low an interest rate the next year. That's one disadvantage. And of course, the second disadvantage is that because the short-term loans are non-renewable, then the interest rate becomes variable and uncertain, and it's difficult to forecast and plan ahead. Now, let's talk about some of the kinds of policies for working capital financing that companies can pursue. Generally speaking, firms pursue what is known as a moderate working capital financing policy. What does that mean? It means basically that firms will prefer to finance the fixed long-term assets as well as the permanent current assets through long-term financing. And they will finance the temporary or spontaneous portion of the current assets by means of short-term financing and short-term loans. And the logic over here is maturity matching. So what this basically means is that the overall logic is to match the maturity of the loan to the economic life of the asset. In other words, if the economic life of the raw material is roughly 1 year, then the firm should use a 1 year or short-term loan to finance its purchase. Very, very generally speaking here. Now, there are two other policies that a firm can follow. One of them is known as the aggressive policy. In the aggressive policy, the firm tries to maximize the use of short-term loans for as many of the assets as possible. They try to maximize using the short-term loan to purchase as many of the assets as possible. So in this particular case of the aggressive policy, the firm will use short-term financing to buy the entire portion of the temporary current assets and also part of the permanent current assets. So what this means is that, again, in the aggressive policy, the firm is using long-term financing to buy the long-term fixed assets, but it is using short-term financing to buy the temporary current assets as well as part of the permanent current assets. Finally, the third policy that is used is known as the conservative policy. In the conservative policy, the firm tries to maximize the use of long-term financing. So, in this case, the firm uses long-term financing to buy the long-term fixed assets, to buy the permanent portion of the current assets, and also to buy a part of the temporary current assets. So these are the three different kinds of policies that firms follow for working capital financing, and you should be familiar with each one of them. Working capital financing and working capital management is covered in chapters 20 and 21 of Financial Management Theory and Practice 8th edition by Brigham and Kapinski. I would like to stop the presentation of the new material, and with this we will close our discussions on working capital management and working capital financing. With this, I close this lecture on working capital management and working capital financing. I thank you for your kind attention and patience. Aapko Virtual University of Pakistan, Ministry of Science and Technology اور مبشر ہمایوں کی طرف سے بہت بہت شکریہ. خدا حافظ اور السلام علیکم.